Hey, folks, it's your lucky day because we have a great show coming up on This Week in Law. Jillian York from the EFF, Larry Downs from Everywhere, Evan Brown, of course, and me. We're going to talk about electronic privacy in connection with the General Petraeus scandal, text spam cases, post-election tech policy, global text policy at the IGF and Wicket, and lots more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown. Episode 188, recorded November 16th, 2012. Big Shirtless is watching you. Hi there, I'm Denise Howell, and you have joined us for This Week in Law. I am so excited about this week's show. We have a great panel and a ton of stuff to talk about. Folks in the headlines have definitely been giving us a lot of fodder for TWiL lately. Joining us once again is Larry Downs. Hello, Larry.
Denise, how are you today?
I'm great, especially because you're back on the show and you are one of my, I've got to say, all-time favorite panelists to have join us. So it's wonderful to have you back.
Well, thank you. It's a mutual admiration society.
All right. Also joining us, a first-timer to This Week in Law, but from one of our old friends where we constantly pilfer guests whenever we can, is Jillian York from EFF. Hello, Jillian.
Hi. Thanks for having me on this week.
It's great to have you. Also joining us, of course, from Chicago, Illinois, and the Hinshaw and Culbertson Law Firm is Evan Brown. Hello, Evan.
Hi, Denise. I hope your Friday is treating you well. I'm looking forward to this conversation. It should be a fun one.
It should indeed. I think because there has been so much blowing up on the privacy front, we'll start there with General Petraeus et al. So let's talk about privacy. All right, so everyone in the world has now learned how the government can find out who you are, even if you're using an anonymous email account, and track you down, and even if you're doing sort of CIA tradecraft and using secret drop boxes, you can be discovered. This has all been very fascinating. I keep thinking about how screenwriters and television writers must all be taking down the details of the unfolding General Petraeus email account scandal and trying to incorporate those into their latest crime dramas. So taking a step back away from the tawdriness of it all, Evan, what do you think this is teaching us as a practical matter? Is it teaching us to be more careful as individuals, or is it teaching us that the laws governing what law enforcement can do and how they can do it need to be examined?
There's something for everyone in this story. Obviously, there's the human layer to it, and if we were to examine the personal, psychological, relationship kind of dynamics that are going on here, there's all of the issues that go with that. Clearly, just to jump right into what folks like us are going to be most concerned about in this, it's the privacy aspect and the way that those rights and those interests, at least, as I guess as much as we can say the interests in privacy, how those play out in the communications between General Petraeus and Paula Broadwell, and particularly how the government plays into this in its investigation of the emails between Paula Broadwell and Jill Kelly down in Florida, Jill Kelly being the other woman in this situation, or the alleged other woman, you know what I mean. So it's a wonderful opportunity. It's almost a textbook example. One would be hard pressed to write a better sort of hypothetical to shine light on these various privacy issues. I think probably what the overarching thing, one of the at least one of the most salient things we learn from this is the kind of no man's land that privacy interests exist in emails that are stored, like what General Petraeus and Paula Broadwell were doing, their methodology here, keeping communications in a draft message in a Gmail account, how that the laws, the whole framework for the system is archaic. These laws originate back to 1986. They certainly have been amended from time to time, particularly with the Patriot Act. But still, these privacy laws for electronic communications are archaic. And then it also just is a larger reminder that it's very difficult to, or maybe the way I should say it is, it's very easy to communicate electronically in a way that the government can snoop on you. What makes it especially intriguing is the fact that, and it makes it ironic, doesn't it, that this was the director of the CIA, ostensibly a person who should know the most about how to communicate covertly. I think there's a lot to be said about the fact that it was a personal issue on the side. He really couldn't use the full, robust sophistication of the CIA's resources to communicate privately. This was kind of pushed out to the side, so he's kind of a victim of that. But lots of issues from this, lots of different ways we can approach this. And interestingly enough, even though it uncovered something that was ethically wrong, certainly ethically wrong in General Petraeus's mind, and eliciting scorn from certain folks who are holier than thou, saying that he and Paula Broadwell were bad for getting involved in this affair, it certainly does present issues on the other side. Wait, where are the privacy interests? How are the privacy interests being protected here, as if to imply that this shouldn't have ever been brought to public light? So tons of interesting things arise out of this.
Right. There's a great piece at the ACLU, if you're interested in the details of what happened here, called Surveillance and Security Lessons from the Petraeus Scandal by Chris Sohigian over there. And it goes into some detail on how they identified Ms. Broadwell, even though she took steps not to send these threatening emails from her home internet connection. She was in hotels and on other third-party wireless networks. And one of the lessons out of this is that, well, there may be some warrant requirements and, grand jury requirements to get at the content of somebody's email account, but if they're just looking for someone's identity, the government has a whole lot of resources at its disposal by being able to just subpoena without a court order, or even just, make a casual request for, can we see the identity of everyone who was using your broadband network on a certain day? And what they were able to do, going back from the IP addresses, I guess they were able to determine from the anonymous emails, they were able to start cross-referencing the names that were on these various broadband networks. And, within looking at two or three iterations, they were able to find, a common name that kept popping up, and there was Ms. Broadwell. So pretty, ingenious. I'm sure it happens all the time in law enforcement. It's just sort of eye-opening for me personally to see them going through these steps. But they're smart folks, and this is something that there, is really no control on their doing whatsoever. Does that give you pause at all, Larry?
Well, sure. I mean, I've been, one of the many people who have been calling for the last several years, but certainly the last couple of years, for significant update to the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. This is the bill that Evan just referred to, the 1986 law that governs how wiretapping relates to the Fourth Amendment. And it's grossly out of date. There's been a couple of circuits, in fact, that have said a big piece of that, the Stored Communications Act, is in fact unconstitutional when applied as opposed to the Fourth Amendment. But there really hasn't been a whole lot of traction. The last term of Congress, Senator Leahy has introduced an ECPA reform bill. There's some talk about it in the House as well, but it really has not moved very far. And interestingly enough, I've heard the Petraeus story being used politically for both sides of this argument. Some people saying, see, this proves, you know, if the CIA director himself doesn't have any privacy, clearly we need to reform the wiretapping laws. But I've also heard people on the other side saying, look, if the CIA director is involved in inappropriate behavior that could compromise national security, this proves we don't want to, in fact, make it harder for law enforcement to get at whatever kinds of communications they're interested in. And in fact, Congressman Goodlatte, who's set to be the new chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, has said, you know, it's not time to talk about ECPA reform, at least not in the lame duck Congress, as a response to the Petraeus situation. But I also, and I think it was in that ACLU piece, Denise, that you just pointed to, it's also worth noting that it sounds like, you know, the general made some pretty rookie mistakes that, in fact, not necessarily, you know, possible to get caught, but they didn't make it all that hard. They could have been using services, free services that, you know, hid some of their IP addresses or rerouted them through anonymous servers, and apparently didn't do that. And it does make one wonder, you know, if the director of the CIA doesn't understand the sort of easiest way to hide their actions, you know, what does that say about the readiness of the CIA to be our key source of information and protection from so-called, you know, cyber terrorists?
I've thought of this in terms of the CIA triad that folks in privacy circles talk about, you know, confidentiality, availability, and integrity. And you wonder how much the availability of the information, the desire to keep this information available, compromised the confidentiality of this. I'm you know, characterize it in terms of the CIA triad just to underscore the irony a little bit more of all this, because, you know, a service like PrivNote would have been very good for this. PrivNote.com, where it's automatically destroyed upon being read the first time. You can't open up the link more than once, for example. But, you know, I suppose that there was a desire to keep this information available. So to the extent that, you know, you don't want to keep it around, it's more likely to fall prey, you know, a threat to its confidentiality or its integrity, for that matter. Not so much of a relevant point of the triad in this analysis, but certainly the confidentiality and the availability points in the triad certainly play into this. So irony any way you look at it in this situation.
Yeah, the ACLU piece points out that although this may have been sort of a neat trick, this dead drop technique of leaving drafts for one another, it may have been sort of a neat trick when it was first conceived of, that it's been around for a while and that folks in security circles should know that. They talk about it having been used by Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, Richard Reed, the shoe bomber, the 2004 Madrid train bombers, terrorists in Germany, as well as some domestic eco-terrorists. And it has appeared in federal court documents as early as 2003 and was described in a Law Journal article written by Justice Department officials in 2004. So, as they say, hardly a state secret. Jillian, what are your thoughts on this?
You know, I'm probably one of the few that wasn't surprised that this is how they got caught, because, you know, if you look at the techniques employed by anyone trying to keep their communications secret, from Syrian activists, and, you know, most of my work is international, so that's where my brain goes, but to I guess, terrorists, the fact is that most people don't have the information on how to keep their digital communications secure. And frankly, you know, I mean, I've never seen PrivNote before, so I can't speak to its security, but there have been a number of tools over the past couple of years that people used, thought were secure, and as it turns out, they weren't, including one that's been heavily promoted for use by Chinese dissidents. And so, you know, for me, it's all about a couple of tools, one of which Chris Segoyan mentions in that blog post, Tor, which is really the only totally secure anonymity tool that I know of. But, you know, I mean, this email, the dead drop idea, yeah, I would say, I mean, that's not something I would ever consider to be safe, nor would I think that, you know, I mean, I would recognize that by staying in a hotel, you know, my records are actually being made public, or are available, easily available publicly. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, there are measures that could have been taken here pretty easily, and I'm not suggesting they should have. You know, like I said, not interested in getting into the nitty gritty of the actual events here. But you know, if you were to take this situation and say, you know, apply it to a situation where somebody has a genuine need for you know, the security and safety of their life, these are pretty bad practices.
So, Larry, according to David Kravitz over at Wired, the Senate Judiciary Committee announced yesterday it'll be voting on November 29th, just around the corner here, on whether to advance Senator Leahy's legislation that would require authorities to obtain a probable cause warrant to get access to all email and other content stored in the cloud. But it sounded like from your comments earlier, you don't really think that that's going to go anywhere right now.
No, it's not. It's clearly not going to go anywhere in the lame duck session. As I say, Congressman Goodlatte, who's set to become the new head of the House Judiciary Committee, has said he won't do it in the lame duck session. But, you know, the Digital Due Process Coalition is the group that's been, for the last couple of years now, really working with Congress to try and push through reforms of this legislation. And, I think the point that's important to understand is, which is surprising, is that, you know, for these services, these cloud services that store user information, but not on your own device. Of course, if it was on my home computer, as everybody would imagine, you would need a warrant, come into my house, and you would need a warrant, probable cause, and so on, by a judge to look at it, to seize it, to search it. But if it's a third party that's storing the information, which of course increasingly is all information now with the advent of the cloud, the government does not need a warrant, or at least not in the circuits that haven't yet ruled on this. They just need a subpoena, and that means just that the person looking for the information themselves is the one who says, yeah, I think this is, you know, important enough that I should be able to get access to it. That's, I think, would probably surprise many people, and I don't know all Americans, but many people, I think, would be surprised to know that the data that's stored in the cloud, generally speaking, is not protected by the Fourth Amendment. At least not in the courts that haven't said so, and that's really the main reform that needs to take place. Clearly not in this Congress, but maybe in the next one.
Evan, what do you think about the aspect of this where they were going through trying to find what happened with Ms. Broadwell and you know who was threatening Ms. Kelly, but they found a whole lot of other stuff too that led to actions being taken that, you know, whether criminal or job related or what have you, had negative impacts on the people involved. Do you think that the digital plain view doctrine needs to be reexamined?
That's a good way of putting it. I mean, I don't know that I've necessarily before thought of it in terms of a digital plain view doctrine, but that certainly is what is going on here. And you're referring to an analog world notion under the Fourth Amendment, where if the cops are searching a place, for example, and say they're there on a to serve a warrant to look for firearms, and they see drugs on the table, then they can go ahead and look for, you know, get that as evidence, even though their warrant didn't talk about drugs in the first place. So, it should come as no surprise that sort of stuff happens, especially when you have personalities like the FBI agents who are investigating these things, who certainly want to do what they need to do to discharge their mission, to be good law enforcement officers and doing the things that they need to be doing here. So that's why it should come as no surprise. In particular, I mean, I don't know the timeline of when this, Agent Shirtless, you know, the Jill Kelly's friend who was assigned to the case originally. I don't know when he was put on the case or when he got taken off the case. I don't know if anybody knows. But, you know, his personality in particular is reported to really be a bulldog type where, you know, you get your teeth into something and you won't let go. So why should we be surprised that that's how the investigation is going to run its course? And then where do we draw the line as a matter of public policy for where what you very aptly articulated as the digital plain view doctrine, where should that cut off? Because you know how I roll. Every time I start talking about civil liberties and all this stuff, then I just I'm so extreme and bring up Al-Qaeda. You know, if you were investigating somebody from the Mexican drug cartel, for example, and you realize that they had ties to Al-Qaeda and were going to be blowing up buildings in a large city that you didn't know was going to happened from doing that research or that investigation initially, sure, you want to be able to make that leap. So how do we articulate as a matter of policy where that plain view doctrine, you know, the contours that are established by that plain view doctrine? But it, I like the way that you have, Denise, have made that metaphor, because it makes good sense. And we definitely see, I guess you could characterize it as collateral damage in that, in what's happened here because of all that, how the investigation, kind of the same thing happened in Whitewater. Remember, that's how the Monica Lewinsky thing got right. uncovered, because of Bill Clinton's involvement in the Whitewater scandal. So we've seen it. We have plenty of analogies to make.
Yes, indeed. I don't know if any, this is just an aside, I don't know if any of you saw the Daily Show coverage of this, but Jon Stewart's reaction was, "What does this woman smell like?" referring to Miss Kelly and how she has this strange impact on people. And my mother was pointing out, you know, she's one heck of a multitasker too, I guess, mom of two, and just has a lot of balls in the air. Anyway, so...
You really said that.
No pun intended whatsoever.
No.
So let's go ahead and make ECPA, the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. And let's be sure to point out, too, that over at the ACLU, if you want to let your lawmakers know that Senator Leahy's bill or other attention should be higher on the list of things that Washington is paying attention to, we'll put it in the show notes at thisweekinlaw.com/thisweekinlaw/188 for episode 188 here. There's a page where you can contact your representative and let them know that it's time to modernize our privacy law. It seems like a good idea to me. So we'll go ahead and hope that you do that. And move on to, let's talk about some other privacy-related considerations here. Microsoft apparently had their data disclosure policy come under review by Washington, and came under some criticism for what they said they were doing versus what they were actually doing, and made some changes to tighten all that up. And now Microsoft has made its intentions clear, they say. This all relates to how they're going to use your data with respect to online advertising. Evan, are you sleeping better at night knowing that Microsoft has taken care of this little issue?
Well, I mean, there's a couple of thoughts I have about this. First of all, it seems like Microsoft has been progressive in the do not track front. I mean, these actions that we're talking about here, it's my understanding based on this piece in the New York Times that this doesn't pertain to Internet Explorer, but that's all, you know, they've already been very consumer friendly. Microsoft has already been very consumer friendly in what it's at least tried to do, much to the resistance that Apache and, you know, others have said, you know, in response to Microsoft's do not track actions here. So when I first heard about this, I thought, you know, I really want to hear what Larry has to say about what this says about Microsoft's psyche, if you will. If it seems like it's being very, I mean, yeah, there's plenty to be gained by from a public relations standpoint and being very pro-consumer privacy and all this stuff. But is Microsoft a little bit scared? You know, I'm thinking, I think it was in a piece that you had written, Larry, talking about, you know, Microsoft and how it is a little bit weakened in the wake of, you know, all the antitrust stuff that went on almost 15 years or so ago now. It just seems like this is a soft response by Microsoft. I don't know quite what to make of it, other than to say, well, it sure does sound good from the consumer privacy standpoint, but I don't know how to add much more nuance to it than that.
Yeah, well, I think that all companies are now kind of operating on a eggshell walking basis with particularly with the Federal Trade Commission, which keeps rattling its saber about privacy issues. They, you know, open investigations, people settle before there's actually any kind of resolution or any kind of real determination of what was or wasn't legal. And in the case of this Microsoft case, what happened was they made a change to their privacy policy. I actually thought it was, you know, relatively inert change and not all that different than the Google equivalent. And what happened was the New York Times wrote a story saying, hey, there was no outrage about the change to the Microsoft policy. How unusual, because, you know, normally when other people make a similar change, people get upset. But this Microsoft change went without notice. And then, you know, the Federal Trade Commission saw the New York Times article saying there was no outrage and went back to Microsoft and said, hey, wait, you know, we're outraged. So they responded accordingly. Look, the problem here is, I should say, this partly, as you say, Evan, that Microsoft is generally speaking very careful with the government, I think, from its previous experience. But they're not alone. I mean, Facebook, Twitter, Google, they're all in the gun sights, particularly of the Federal Trade Commission. And, the commission is just not being clear about what it thinks the rules are, what it wants the rules to be, what it says the law is. And I'm, you know, very concerned about it. I was at a conference over the summer where one of the commissioners, Julie Brill, was talking about privacy and saying, you know, we think we understand that we as regulators should have a certain amount of humility about new products and services. But we think that companies should be humble, too. And we don't want them, and now I'm paraphrasing, but we don't want them to introduce new features that are too, you know, disruptive to the sort of privacy question, because that upsets consumers, and then we feel like we have to step in. And I was just appalled by that statement. I mean, the idea that, you know, the regulator is telling entrepreneurs they should be humble when they're launching new products and services just strikes me as kind of the best example I can of Washington not understanding how entrepreneurship works, not understanding, you know, the very dynamic market that these companies operate in. And as I said in a piece on Forbes about this, you know, in Silicon Valley here, we have a special name for companies that are humble. We call them failures.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, at least in Canada, they seem to be paying attention at a more official level to the notion of privacy by design and sort of private industry and individuals stepping in to take action here, to take control of data and have an ecosystem where they're calling it the personal data ecosystem, where folks, you know, have, whether it's a vault or a bank or however you want to say it, as central repository for their data. And then they parse it out from there based on very specific requests and consent, as opposed to, you know, having a privacy update come along that they may or may not have read and have it, you know, then dictate that they now get targeted ads. This is from Dr. Anne Kavoukian, Ontario's Information and Privacy Commissioner, who has a lengthy paper, Privacy by Design and the Emerging Personal Data Ecosystem, that sort of lays out the roadmap for that and talks about companies like Personal and Respect and Control Shift over in England. Jillian, do you think that this is the direction we should be headed, or should it be from a more legislative and regulatory perspective, or is there some kind of convergence that's necessary?
No, I mean, you know, I hesitate for it to, well, I mean, it's a tough question. I mean, I think that there's certainly benefit to some of this coming from a legislative perspective. But at the same time, I think what we're looking at is a new ecosystem in which companies, you know, need to kind of set themselves ahead by thinking about things like privacy by design, or, you know, most of what I work on is free expression. And so, you know, another area where as companies own more and more of our speech, they'll need to set themselves apart by, you know, having stronger protections for that speech. And right now I would say most of them don't. And so looking at this, I mean, I do think that this is a great initiative that will help companies set themselves apart moving forward. But at the same time, you know, when we're looking at the big companies, the Googles, the Microsofts of this world, I don't know what their incentive is. And so that's where we need to start looking at regulation more.
All right. Well, let's move on. We talked a bit about it earlier, and let's look at it more closely. The fact that, Microsoft was under scrutiny some 15 years ago for its actions that were characterized as antitrust, and it was prosecuted by the DOJ and various states' attorney generals for those actions. Now Google is in the sights. And the rumors are flying that there may be charges against Google by the end of this year. Nothing has happened yet, but definitely an investigation has been going on, and it mostly has to do with preferential treatment in search results. But when you look at the way that Google is so inextricably part of so many parts of our lives, and it's getting to be more and more so, you know, certainly the investigators seem to think they have something to talk about. Larry, what do you think?
Oh, I think it's just garbage. Look, you know, non-antitrust people throw around words like monopoly and antitrust very, very dangerously, I think. There's just no case here. Now, the investigation has been going on for, I think now, coming up on 2 years. And that in itself is a kind of a crime. I mean, the company obviously is distracted by that. They're spending money, but the money isn't the issue. They're looking over their shoulder at, again, usually I'm beating up on the Federal Communications Commission. Today, I'll beat up on the Federal Trade Commission. The FTC has been, you know, looking down their sights on Google for almost 2 years without doing anything. And that in itself, I think, speaks volumes to the process. It takes regulators that long just to decide whether or not there's a, you know, significant violation of trade law and not just antitrust law. Meanwhile, of course, what's happened in the 2 years that since they started, so much has changed, who owns who and who does what and who offers what service, that in effect they would have to start over. And I think part of the reason this has gone on so long without any kind of actual complaint being filed is that they have to keep starting over as things keep changing. They just can't keep up. But, you know, the bottom line here is under, and I think there was a good CNET piece on this by Ryan Radia at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Under antitrust law, you have to have harm to consumers. That's the standard by which, you know, we measure whether or not some practice is in fact illegal. And it's very difficult to find harm to consumers when, first of all, you know, essentially you're largely offering free services when there are competing services available. Obviously, people don't choose them to the same extent they choose Google because they like Google. But, you know, Bing is a real alternative. And in fact, according to Microsoft, it's gaining significantly in market share. If consumers are being harmed, it's very difficult to see where that harm is. And I think that's part of why it's taken the FTC so long to invent a case here. There's, you know, competitors may be being harmed, but that's the way competitive markets work. That's not legally something that the government can intercede with. It has to be consumer harm, and it has to be demonstrable, and it's just not there.
You know, one of the things that's been interesting to me about this, just the timing of it, is that Google more and more is becoming beyond search and has gone into the hardware business, both with phones and now with, not that it's manufacturing them, but it's certainly the infrastructure behind the Chromebooks that are out there and the couple that have come out recently and have been gaining headlines. We just purchased one of those, and in getting it out and setting it up, it occurred to me, you know, that years and years ago, if Microsoft had come out with a, you know, Windows book, and it only ran Explorer, that certainly that would never have passed muster in the antitrust debacle that it was involved in. Now, of course, Microsoft was the quote-unquote monopoly operating system, and the Chrome OS is nothing at this point, you know, a tiny, tiny fraction of the OS is out there. So you're not in the same situation. But still, you know, for a company facing all this antitrust scrutiny, it's kind of a bold move to put out pieces of hardware that are so designed around its own ecosystem. Do you think so, Evan, or am I just, you know, not on the right track here?
It's an aggressive move. It may rise to the level of being bold. You know, I suppose we could talk about the semantics behind that. the bottom line for me is if Larry says it's garbage, then, you know, I'm going to believe that it's garbage too. I'm not going to argue with that. The way that I would approach it is to recognize that you know, Google plays a very important role in our information economy. And I would guess from a practical matter, maybe I should just put it in my calendar to check back in 5 years to see what Google's doing, seeing how the market share is, you know, whether Bing is really gaining traction like Microsoft says that it is, and all of that stuff. It seems like a very difficult analysis to make when we're, I mean, first of all, there is the question that Ryan Radio was talking about, you know, the second part of his analysis talked about where's the harm, what are the damages. But then there's also this more tricky part of figuring out whether there really is any kind of conduct on the part of Google that is serving to do away with competition itself. And it's that's a really difficult analysis question to ask, because, you know, the gripe with Google is that it's favoring information content being produced from its own product. So say, for example, a blog post written on Blogger might show up than one higher in the search results, have a better page rank than one from WordPress would, or a Picasa photo might show up higher than one from Flickr, or we could iterate a bunch of different kind of examples like that. So how do we really isolate that being an anti-competitive behavior, distinguishing that from the fact that these products are just built to do their job well, to deliver relevant results to someone in the platform on which the content is being published? How do we know that it's just not that's working really well? It's not like mm-hmm. Standard Oil gasoline was any better than any other type of petroleum products out there, as far as I know. I'm totally making that up. I don't know anything about the quality of Standard Oil gas, but I make things up all the time. So, but I mean, you know, the conduct on the part of Standard Oil was much different than what we were talking about with Google here, or at least you can draw look at things that Google is doing that Standard Oil probably wasn't doing when it comes to the actual quality of the products and something like that. So this whole question of whether there really is anti-competitive behavior seems one that's almost impossible to ask. It's like circular when you try to evaluate whether it really is anti-competitive.
Well,
Greg Sterling.
I just want to say, you know, anti-competitive behavior is not illegal. That's what capitalism is. You're trying to damage your competitors to your own advantage. Now, it can rise to the level of a civil or a criminal violation if you do it in ways that harm consumers. But if you're just getting an advantage over your competitors, that's a good thing.
Yeah, I really do recommend this article that we've been referring to over at CNET. It's lengthy and it's an opinion piece on laying out all the points, you know, that Google would make if it were to face antitrust kind of charges. So the Ryan Radia piece is definitely required reading on this topic. Another interesting piece is over at Search Engine Land by Greg Sterling. And Greg's theory is that the reason that we're talking about this at all, he notes that what the Wall Street Journal and Bloomberg both reported according to Bloomberg, FTC Chairman Jonathan Leibowitz is pressing Google to settle potential antitrust claims in the next few days or face a formal complaint. This is according to people familiar with the situation, which according to Greg suggests FTC employees who want to put more public pressure on Google to settle. So that, you know, this is according to Greg, perhaps a strategic leak to have Google make more concessions and not have to go through formal proceedings. Jillian, do you think that any of this, you know, Google having scrutiny and perhaps having to make concessions either in formal proceedings or otherwise, has any impact on the kinds of things you're generally thinking about, free speech and civil liberties? Do you fear for Google or not?
Hard to say. Hard to say what kind of impact this has on my work, to be perfectly honest.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, whether or not Google is able to have a lot of irons in the fire and decide what search results it prevents, you don't think that we start to get into sort of a censorship kind of scenario?
It does, but I mean, like you said before, it's difficult when you've got this broad ecosystem where you do have alternatives. You know, you do have Bing, you do have all of these other search engines available. I mean, for me, my concern is, you know, Google doing all of the stuff that they're you know, the bigger they grow, the more disparate their policy implementation becomes, and their policy teams all over the world, et cetera. And so for me, it's about the decision making within the company that really concerns me for my work. And so, you know, the more, I guess, irons they have in the fire, so to speak, the more inconsistent that becomes.
Gotcha. Well, let's move on. Evan, we've talked before. I think it was Nilay Patel who coined the term taco suit on our show a while back. And we have a great example, or maybe not, of something that that Nilay might call a taco suit, which is actually it's quite a flurry of suits against folks who are using text messaging promotions. And the one, and this was Steve Nipper actually sent me the story about the guy who is suing the Buffalo Bills. This is the most recent one I've heard of. He signed up to receive text alerts from the Bills. And apparently he was told that there would be only, I think it was two messages a week. But he wound up getting more than that. And no, let's see, it was five text alerts per week. 1 week he got six, and 1 week he got seven. So, it, you know, someone overstepped the terms of service there regarding text messages. And this gentleman, his name is Jerry. Oh gosh, I can't pronounce it. Wojcik, maybe. He has brought a class action lawsuit under, the act is the Telecommunications, Telephone Consumer Protection Act.
TCPA.
Yes, TCPA. Another older piece of legislation that I don't think probably was ever envisioning the kind of world we live in now, where people are getting texts right and left on their smartphones. So this one, we don't know what's going to happen. It's just been filed over at Eric Goldman's blog. Venkat Balasubramani is rolling his eyes over this one, saying, okay, you know, this is a step too far. But I don't know if I agree with him. You know, if you have given express consent for a certain amount of texts and someone is abusing that express consent, I think you might well have a lawsuit under this. Evan, is this a taco suit or not?
This is worse than a taco suit. I mean, I hear what you're saying. Yeah, maybe there's technically some liability here, but if there is, it at best belongs in like a small claims court somewhere, not a $70 million lawsuit. I mean, let's back up. First of all, how utterly uncool is it to sue your football team? You know, I mean, are you, you're obviously not a fan if you're suing, you know, that's just uncool. You lose, you know, whatever. And then, I mean, I'm surprised that you're giving this any merit at all, Denise. I'm being kind of solicitous saying that it should belong in even a small claims court. Cause when I first read this, I was just thinking, you know, the unadulterated stupidity of bringing a lawsuit like this really just speaks for itself. And there's not a whole lot to say about it. We're talking about getting a couple of extra text messages a month, filing this huge federal lawsuit for millions of dollars. Just, you've heard me talk time and time again how these class action lawsuits brought by opportunistic plaintiff's lawyers do not serve the public interest. They just serve to make plaintiff's lawyers rich. And that's not doing anybody any good. Even maybe the plaintiff's lawyers, because more money, more problems. Make them rich, make them buy fancy cars and make a bunch of bad decisions and go into debt and end up whatever. So it's not helping. It's not helping anybody. It's just really silly.
Maybe the fact that you can bring a lawsuit of this scope is exorbitant under the law. I'd have to maybe grant you that one. You know, there really was a taco suit. There was one of these suits against Taco Bell about. Now, this one, I think we can all agree was just a pile of steaming, shouldn't have been filed, because this person, eBay, in eBay versus, that is I-B-E-Y, versus Taco Bell, complained about the fact that he he had first signed up for some sort of text notification, and then he changed his mind and sent a stop message. And in response, he got a confirmation text back, and that's what he sued over, that after he'd told them to stop, that they sent one more text telling him, okay, we're going to stop.
What a victim.
So, yes, yes, yes. But there was a related case just decided here on November 9th, and this is the one Venkat was writing up, involving Walmart now. And here we've got a slightly different situation. Here the person gave their phone number to the Walmart pharmacy for unspecified purposes. You know, and the assumption, I think, reasonably enough, would be if you're giving your phone number to the pharmacy, that they would contact you about pharmacy-related important issues and not marketing things. Well, they started receiving marketing texts and they sued. And what the court here found was that just the giving over of the phone number was enough to give consent to them using that phone number however Walmart liked. And again, it's a problem under the TCPA and the way it's been interpreted, that courts have found that texts and phone calls to be basically the same under the Act. The Act doesn't specify. The Act, you know, was enacted before texts existed. And so, you know, if you've given someone your phone number, you're out of luck, says the court in this Walmart case. Larry, are we once again looking at a situation where we just need to really look at these older laws and bring them into conformity with the way people actually use technology?
Yeah, it's partly that. And I think it's partly a problem of drafting that happens with a lot of these laws. So I'm not quite as down on class actions in general as Evan seems to be. I take it Evan is not a class action plaintiff side lawyer. They do serve a valuable purpose, even if it's the most of the money goes to the lawyers. It still can be an effective deterrent. The problem with acts like this one is that you create a federal cause of action. There's no kind of minimal level of harm, and then if you do win, there's what's called statutory damages. So, you know, yes, there was technically a violation of the terms of service here with the Buffalo Bills, but if a court was going to actually determine the damages, they would find, you know, there'd be no evidence of any real damages, or it'd be so tiny that it wouldn't be worth calculating. When the statute gives statutory damages and says, you know, each violation is, I don't know what this particular one is, $100 or $1,000, well, that creates a very attractive incentive for a class action lawyer to say, oh, great, you know, we can use that. And it happens on non-internet cases too. There's constantly class actions involving the I can't remember all the various mortgage laws and disclosure laws having to do with when you apply for a mortgage, and even a tiny technical violation of those will get you big statutory damages. And then, of course, if you compound those with a class action, you're talking some real money. It's obviously not what was intended. And again, I think the danger here isn't just that the statute is old, but also that it gave a private right of action that included statutory damages as a remedy.
All right, Evan, let's switch the facts up a little bit and talk about the Papa John's case. Also getting sued in Walmart-like fashion, the allegations being similar, that people gave their phone numbers, probably thinking that Papa John's might have needed them to make sure that the pizza had been delivered, or, you know, contact you if there's a delay in the delivery. But those phone numbers were in turn taken and put to a different use. Specifically, the company spent some 500,000 texts, promotional texts, sent by a third-party service that they hired in early 2010. And people were really pretty outraged by this. This still strikes you as something that, you know, people shouldn't be bothering to sue about?
Well, there's definitely, you know, as you said leading into it, there's a definite factual difference here, where there's some the nature of the communications is different. And it sounds like it perhaps was more volume here. I mean, look, we've mm-hmm. all experienced the frustration and the irritation, maybe not so much anymore, but like if you remember 10 years ago, do you remember getting junk faxes you know, where you know, you would get, you know, fax messages sent to you as, oh, this is wasting my paper and stuff. There's that irritation that carries over even into the modern era of getting text messages that you don't want to get. You're not, you know, it's not wasting a piece of paper, a few pieces of paper every time. But so, I mean, in this situation, I guess technically it's not a different, it's not different in kind. Yes, there should be, you know, on the binary question of liability, yes or no, is this a violation of the act? It's the same question as that we're asking whether the Buffalo Bills sent one or two extra text messages in a week or a month or whatever. Yeah, it's just as the question of liability is exactly the same. But, you know, given that the nature of it is different, it seems like there really is more of a potential for harm here. So even though, as Larry correctly observes, I'm not a plaintiff's class action lawyer. In fact, I work for a firm that does mostly defense, including defensive class action lawsuits. So there's some of my bias or prejudice, as it may be, coming across from all this. You know, I can see it being more plausible and more colorable under the TCPA and the like kind of statutes coming from this, for sure.
Well, I mean, the reason that people would even think about suing this is that their expectation, suing about this, is that their expectations have been upended. You know, if you I think people are hesitant, I don't know, I am anyway, to give their phone number out in the first place. And if they do, they want to know what it's going to be used for. In Venkat's write-up of the Walmart case, he's pointing out a discussion that the court had. This is news to me, that the FCC has a rule that requires written consent, but this rule won't go into effect until October of next year. So until then, we're all sort of sorting out what sort of consent you're giving when you're handing your phone number over in this way. Jillian, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, this is also, you know, another one of those things that's kind of outside of my area of expertise.
Right.
I apologize.
That's okay. No, we're definitely honing in on your area real quick here. So let's talk about it from a personal standpoint, just so I have you at least weigh in on the topic. When you get these kinds of unsolicited texts, you know, is it an annoyance to you, or do you ever consider that, gee, this shouldn't happen?
Yeah, no, absolutely. It drives me nuts.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, I'm somebody who didn't have an unlimited plan until fairly recently. I'm kind of behind the curve on this sort of thing, especially
right.
for my age group, I think. So yeah, no, it's definitely obnoxious. Wish that there were a simpler way to block them or report them for that matter. And I still haven't even figured out how to do that. So yeah, I mean, on the other hand, though, as we move toward I think the lawsuit's just as ridiculous as everyone else has already stated, but as we move toward a sort of epoch where everyone does have unlimited text messages, then I think we're looking at a different question, because there's no real cost involved.
Right. Well, AT&T is trying to move us there, aren't they, Larry? Better broadband, better network. Tell us about what they're up to here.
So AT&T last week made a pretty bold announcement. They announced that they were going to accelerate by an additional $14 billion over several billion already committed to make significant upgrades both to their wireless network as well as their wireline network. I think one of the things that becomes apparent in this announcement is just how integrated increasingly those two sets of networks are, and not just for AT&T, but for all carriers. Obviously, the mobile use is what we see and what's get all the attention and the devices and the apps. But of course, you don't have a effective cellular network without extremely good and increasingly high bandwidth backhaul through the wireline system. So even though we're no longer really using our wireline telephones, or, you know, the sort of what's known as a plain old telephone service, that's been dropping and dropping and dropping for years. The infrastructure is still extremely important to the cellular system and its performance. And so what they're saying they're going to do is, I can't remember, it's $8 billion for one and $6 billion for the other. But a part of it is to greatly expand the deployment of fiber and at the same time to retire the copper network, because apparently physically, copper just cannot handle high speeds, and it, you know, it can't really be upgraded the way the cable network has successfully been over the last decade. So they want to retire the copper and replace it with fiber. That's great. And they also want to retire the networking protocols that were used on old wireline telephones, a sort of dedicated switch, dedicated circuit technology, which is known as TDM, and replace that with IP, the Internet Protocol. And that's the amazing part to me of this announcement is, you know, if you'd asked 20 years ago, or even 10 years ago for that matter, if you could imagine a future in which TCP/IP, the Internet Protocol, that, you know, sort of developed initially by the government, non-proprietary, free to anybody, very low-level protocol, that was going to be the one and only protocol that was used for exchanging information, whether it was over the television network, over the telephone network, radio, data, all these different networks were all going to converge to a single set of hardware, in this case, fiber and high-speed cellular, but also one software standard, one networking protocol, and that protocol was going to be IP, I think everybody in every one of those industries would have laughed you out of the room. And yet that's exactly what's happened. So now, you know, they've sort of thrown in the towel on the old proprietary networks and on the old networks that were specific to particular types of communication and said, you know what, everything's a packet. Going to start life as a packet, it's going to end life as a packet, and we're just going to natively transmit everything and connect it through IP protocols, regardless of what actual physical technology we're going to use. And I referred to that in a Forbes piece as Internet Everywhere. It's the kind of, you know, final victory of the Internet over all these other protocols. That were owned by companies, that were highly promoted by companies, including the phone companies, including IBM and DEC and all these other now disappeared technology companies. IP wins. That's the headline.
Right. Over in IRC, Rourkes is chiming in that this is a bad idea because now the phone will be vulnerable to all the Skype-type issues because the IP technology works different than what we're used to in phone technology. As an AT&T customer myself, to hear, you know, about investments in their network is nothing but good news for me. But what do you think about that complaint as to the shift, Larry?
Well, I'm not sure, you know, what kinds of Skype problems. I think, you know, part of the thing with Skype is that it runs over the top. And this mm-hmm. is part of what AT&T is changing here. In some ways, Skype communications get translated back down to these other protocols, depending on what network they're being routed through. That introduces a lot of inefficiency, and therefore, you know, you can get sort of poor service. I think part of the reason sometimes also that Skype can be slow or what it has to do with your own individual connection, again, part of what AT&T is doing here is to upgrade those connections, at least as far as the hubs, if not, you know, fiber to the home. It's at least going to be fiber to somewhere nearby in your neighborhood. And they're going to be using their UVerse protocol, their UVerse technologies, I should say, to implement this. So essentially, you'll get a faster and more efficient connection. And again, one that's natively IP. I suspect, of course, we won't know until it's actually done, but I suspect that will mean that, you know, we won't notice the phone calls being, you know, sort of more Skype-like and less old phone-like. I'm not an AT&T customer. I have Comcast, and I already have IP-based telephony. And I sort of thought when I made the switch, it was a lot cheaper. And I thought, well, you know, my phone service is going to be degraded because it's IP phone service. And that can't be as good as, you know, a dedicated switch. And I've been amazed to find that my phone quality, both in terms of, you know, fidelity as well as reliability, has been much, much better on an IP network, again, using the cable infrastructure, than it ever was over the old and degrading copper. So I doubt that anyone's going to find, you know, there's a lot of things that maybe you could be worried about here. I don't think quality is going to be one of them.
Evan, as we get more internet that actually is competitive with the fast internet speeds that we see in other countries, here in the U.S. Do you think that that will somewhat decrease the net neutrality issues and concerns that we've seen as people deal with the scarce resource?
Well, you would think it would. I'm no economist, mm-hmm. but you know, looking at the supply and demand analysis from this, you would think that if the bandwidth is not as scarce of a resource, there wouldn't be as much of a reason to be so protective, you know, in the role of the providers like this. So, you know, I would defer to what Larry says on that, you know, for the second time, deferring to him on an issue like this, because from a basic fundamental economic standpoint, it would seem to make sense. I trust that the providers could still come up with some business reason, whether it be for just, you know, as basic as having the right to monitor what goes on to the network for performance issues and customer service and all of that stuff, that there would still be some push for the right of the provider to exercise some bit discrimination of some form or another. But boy, it sure does seem like the reduction of scarcity would go a long way toward pulling the rug out from under the network discrimination proponents, I guess.
Right. Larry, as you point out in your lengthy piece at Forbes, this is mostly silver lining, but some people are trying to find clouds. Over at GigaOM, Stacy Higginbotham, if I'm saying her name correctly, is writing that by abandoning copper, AT&T is also leaving some customers out in the cold. You have a pretty detailed response to that. You want to sum it up for us here?
Yes, my summary is Stacy Higginbotham does not understand technology, and I don't understand why anybody reads what she writes about it.
She does write that it's clear that AT&T is running from copper like I'd run from a PR person waving a social media pitch, and I liked that.
I like social media pitches. Sometimes I find them useful. They are running from the copper. The copper is degrading, not only physically, but it just cannot be upgraded the way the cable network has been to deliver any kind of bandwidth for data, and certainly not for IP-based, you know, native IP-based transactions. AT&T has said there's absolutely no way. In fact, legally, this is what she doesn't understand either. Legally, they cannot cut off rural customers in the 22 states that they serve. Same with other providers, by the way. You must continue. And if that means you have to keep operating a copper network in areas where you can't afford or can't get fiber, or where you can't get LTE to offer, you know, sort of intermodal-based alternatives to the copper system, then they're going to keep operating copper. I mean, it's impossible for anybody to be left out. And in fact, what they said is, they're expanding the footprint of their U-verse and their fiber technology within those 22 states. So many more of their customers will have access to it than currently do. The few remaining that don't will either be maintained on the copper network. They have to, as they say, as a matter of law. Or they will get the alternative of high-speed LTE cellular technology, of mobile technology. Of course, we know even without that requirement, people are cutting the cord all the time, having few and fewer people having a home phone that's landline-based, having even television that's cable-based. They're saying, you know, we recognize that trend, and we're going to make it a real viable alternative. And by the way, they can't, you know, charge crazy prices for that again, because as a carrier of last resort, the FCC will make sure that for rural customers and low-income customers, they get dial tone, and they get dial tone at very reasonable rates that are set by the government, regardless of whether it's going to be on copper, whether it's going to be on fiber, or whether it's going to be LTE.
All right. Well, that is good to know, and I am certainly looking forward to upgrades to the AT&T network across the board. I'd love to get U-verse or Fios, you know, somewhere here at my residence, but it's just not available. So hopefully as those things expand, we'll all have, we won't have fiber envy so much anymore. Let's move on. There are so many things happening on the field of international governance of the internet, and lots of talk in the wake of the U.S. elections. So let's talk about some legislation, regulation, and policy. ¶¶ Jillian, you attended the Internet Governance Forum. Can you give us a report from there? What went on and what were your takeaways?
Sure. So this was my first IGF, as it's known. This one was held in Baku in Azerbaijan. And so there were a lot of concerns running up to it about the idea of holding an Internet Governance Forum in a decidedly authoritarian state. The last time that was done was in Egypt in, I think, I want to say 2009. It may have been 2008. And the last two were held in Lithuania and Kenya, respectively. So they were considerably more open. And I think that the first thing I would say is that those concerns were not unfounded. Throughout the forum, we heard reports of Azeris being refused entry. There were accounts of European government officials having their communications hacked or monitored. I'm not sure exactly which. We're still kind of trying to figure out what happened there. And also just lots of suppression of materials. A lot of people bring materials from their organizations to hand out. And there was a lot of, no, you can't do that here, that sort of thing. Not surprising. Now, the forum itself, I don't know how familiar the guests or the audience is on what goes on. But basically, the IGF is, I'm not sure exactly how many years old at this point, but I want to say five, I think that sounds right, and is a multi-stakeholder initiative to essentially determine some of the most difficult things about how the internet is governed and regulated. And so, every workshop that goes into it has to have, a variety of different stakeholders. I co-organized one this year that was looking at the various government initiatives to promote internet freedom. So the U.S. State Department, for example, has been putting in a lot of money on this. There's to promote internet freedom abroad. And there are, I think, 17 governments at this point that have formed a coalition to do the same. And that includes, a number of European countries, but it also includes countries like Ghana and Kenya. And soon Tunisia is also going to be focused on this. And so my panel, for example, had someone from the State Department, someone from the European Commission, a number of academics, myself, and a representative from a grant-making organization in Europe. And so, that's just the kind of thing that goes on there. And I can't say that, there are necessarily any really solid outcomes just yet. I think a lot of the benefit of the IGF is getting these people in the same rooms and sort of hashing out some of these issues for further follow-up later on. But all in all, it was a positive experience, but definitely dampened by some of the incidents that happened around the location.
Right. So tell us about that. What happened?
So those are a couple of those things that I mentioned about the European officials who reported that some of their information was hacked. I'm still not totally clear on the details of that. I have a colleague who's looking into it. And then a couple of Azeris who were refused entry at the door. So that was a concern that's been a concern for a long time. In 2005 with the World, I always forget the acronym, WSIS, World Society... I'm not going to get that one right, but it was held in Tunisia. This was kind of a famous incident where this is a precursor to the IGF. And that was, a scenario where not only were Tunisians largely refused entry, but some of them were actually arrested after the fact for cavorting with these human rights activists. And this time, some of the more well-known Azeri bloggers and dissidents were actually allowed in, but there were others who were less known. And the authorities were able to refuse them entry because nobody really kicked up a fuss about it. So those are the kinds of concerns that we have.
Evan is supplying our Evan's both here and in the chat room helping us fill in blanks in the show. So thanks, Evan. The World Summit on Information Policy, I think, is what you were looking for, per Evan.
Yes, thank you.
Yes. My life is just one big Wikipedia moment. So there you go. that proves it.
Very helpful.
Yes. Perfect.
So other than these sort of location-based issues, Jillian, were there any substantive issues that caused you concern at the IGF?
I think one of the main topics right now, and this was not something that I was particularly involved in, so the trouble with it is you get invited to so many different workshops that it's hard to then go and attend other people's. And so, so most of what I'm hearing is actually after the fact, because I was on five workshops, which is, crazy, and I don't recommend it. But I was kind of filling in for people wanted EFF generally. And so given that there are only two of us there, we both ended up kind of overworking ourselves. But yeah, I mean, one of the biggest concerns that's coming up this year is the potential control of internet regulation by the ITU, which is the International Telecommunications Union. It's a UN agency. And essentially, the concern there is that if the ITU were to have more control over the governance of the internet, then it would be sort of a top-down, government-centric, one vote, one government kind of thing, rather than these multi-stakeholder processes that we've been pushing for so long. And this is going to be decided at the, here's another acronym, WICKET, World Conference on International Telecommunications. Yes, excellent.
There you go. Bing, bing, bing.
Yes, which is coming up in, I want to say, December in Dubai. And only governments get a vote. And so the effort that we've been putting into this is trying to convince governments. I mean, the U.S. is on our side. A lot of Western governments are on our side. But it's a matter of convincing other governments to demand that, you know, we keep the internet open and not let further control by governments. Because what you can see is, you know, if you've been following what's going on, and it's totally not internet related, but, you know, if you're following along with what's happening in Syria and the UN Human Rights Council votes, this is the same kind of, I mean, there's a great analogy there. This is the same kind of thing that I can envision happening in an ITU-controlled internet, where you've got governments like Russia and China trying to stamp down every initiative that comes about, every positive initiative, that is. And so so that's the fear here, is that governments will essentially end up with too much control.
All right. Well, Evan and Larry, do you have any questions for Jillian about the IGF before we move on and talk about WICKET?
Well, didn't Larry say something about the Russians? Well, I guess that's what we were going to talk about, you know, after the
segue.
That's WICKET. So, yeah. Yeah. So.
Yes, indeed. Well, so let's do that. Larry, you have some breaking news just from this morning about the Russian contingency going to the World Conference on
International telecommunications. They want it to be about internet. That's the problem.
Yes.
So,
yes.
You know, we've talked about this on the show before, and I've been writing about this all year. This very big conference coming up in Dubai next month, which will renegotiate what's called the International Telecommunications Regulations. It's a treaty. It's a real treaty. So, you know, it has international legal significance. It's a treaty that started out life having to do with the telegraph and then has moved on to international telecommunications. There's been a push in this next revision that's, I think it's hasn't been revised since 1988. So the ITU itself, which is a body of the United Nations, has been pushing very hard to say, you know, we need to be involved in internet regulation. We need to be involved in internet governance. And there have been a number of countries, as well as private organizations, that have kind of taken that invitation to dump in their own personal pet projects, if you will. These include things like having to do with security, having to do with freedom of speech, having to do with censorship, having to do with payments, sort of how the peering arrangements work, and so on. And many of these proposals are just terrible, not least of which is the idea that it would be enforceable under the sanctions of the United Nations. Of course, you know, not one of our fast-moving regulatory bodies, at least not historically, in a very fast-moving area. As Jillian said, one of the amazing things about this whole process, the renegotiate this treaty, is it turned out to be the only thing that could create bipartisanism in the United States, I think, in the last several years. There's not, as far as I can tell, a single person in or out of the government, at least within the United States and many of our allies, who thinks it's a good idea to take any form of internet governance away from organizations like the Internet Society, which handles the protocols, with ICANN, which handles the domain names and the addressing, and turn them over to any body that's in any way affiliated with the United Nations, and particularly in a conference where all the proceedings are secret, where, as Jillian said, the only people who get a vote are countries, and every country gets exactly the same vote, regardless of their involvement in the internet ecosystem. It's just been a disaster. And as I said before we started the show, just about an hour ago was leaked to me the newest version of the Russian proposals that they're going to ask to be considered as new amendments to the treaty at the conference. As soon as we get done with the show here, I'm going to write this up for CNET, and hopefully there'll be soon a public version of these Russian secret proposals. But mm-hmm. the Russians have not been subtle about this. Vladimir Putin has said repeatedly that he thinks the UN, and particularly the ITU, should be the sole regulator of the Internet. All these multi-stakeholder groups should get out of that business. And in these proposals that they released yesterday, they've asked explicitly for the treaty to be revised, largely to make that point and to say that the countries individually have a complete right to determine what happens with the Internet within their borders, and that they want the UN to make that a fact of the treaty itself. So really some just terrible proposals, I think indicative of just the kind of chaos that's likely to happen at this treaty conference, and something in the 150-year history of the ITU that they've never, ever seen before.
Larry, I think you said a minute ago that this is all going to take place behind closed doors. Will there be any kind of public access to what sort of discussions go on at Wicket?
There will be no official public access. Mm-hmm. There have been a number of sources who have been leaking like crazy. Certainly within the U.S. and European delegations as well. The ITU itself made this a very half-hearted effort. They published one of their secret documents that was a kind of summary of early proposals. It's no longer relevant. And they did this, you know, they really don't have any experience in kind of public relations or dealing with the public. So they've made some terribly embarrassing gaffes. One of the things they did was over the summer, they put on their website a facility where, you know, they invited the internet community to give them feedback on what they thought should be the role of the UN in internet governance. But in order to actually post any comments to that, you had to first agree to a terms of service agreement that about the worst one I've ever seen from a commercial company. And what was the other thing? You had to register and give them all kinds of private information before you could post comments. I think in the end, only 12 people posted comments. And then the Secretary General of the UN, of the ITU, excuse me, wrote a very, you know, heartfelt op-ed on Wired.com a few weeks ago saying, you know, we're being painted in the press as evil and terrible and trying to ruin the internet. We're not trying to do that at all. And we urge you all to give us your comments. Unfortunately, as one of the comments in the article noted, the comment period had actually been closed sometime before that op-ed ran. So that, in fact, if you followed the link he gave and tried to give him their comments, you would have gotten a message saying the open comment period is now closed,
which
kind of gives you some indication of how really interested they are in hearing from the internet community. They also, by the way, their press credentials process, I wasn't going to go anyway. I couldn't really afford a trip to Dubai on the salary that This Week in Law pays me. But the press credentials requirements, you had to prove that you wrote for a print publication, or if you were an online writer, it had to be an online publication that had a print counterpart. So online writer, bloggers, and so on, anyone involved with the actual internet couldn't have attended even as a journalist.
Yeah, a WordPress plugin that lets you print the blog post, would that count, you know, to allow it to be the print counterpart on that?
I very much doubt that.
Yes. It's like our written materials for MCLE. If they can be printed, they are written. Speaking of MCLE, let's make Wicket our second passphrase for the show, since we had an earlier acronym. Let's stick with the theme. WCIT is the second passphrase if you're looking to show that you listened to this show or watched it for MCLE credit. So one of the things lots of folks have been doing in the wake of the election, lots of folks who pay attention to the technology industry anyway, have been writing up wish lists for the tech industry in Washington. Larry, during the election process, you had a great post over on TechDirt of highlighting posts from TechDirt that you wished that the campaigns had been paying attention to and prepping for the debates, since so little pertinent to any of what we've been discussing today actually came up in any of the debate conversations. So let's just go around here. We'll start with you, Larry. What should Washington be paying attention to now? And do you think that in the wake of the election, you know, now that people's focus has shifted, that we'll actually get some attention to these issues?
Right. So it's possible. We had some good and bad things happen in the last Congress, and it's possible that some things will happen in this one. There's already been discussion since the election about immigration reform, and that is, I think, the number one issue, at least here in Silicon Valley, this crazy set of rules that says, you know, when people come over here to get PhDs in engineering at our finest universities, the moment they're ready to become entrepreneurs and start successful businesses, that's the moment that we tell them they have to leave and go and do that in another country and compete against us. It really doesn't make any sense. No one thinks it does. But, of course, it's all wrapped up in the larger issue of immigration reform, which is admittedly much more complicated. If I had to pick a few others, obviously patent reform, the patent system is a mess. Nobody thinks otherwise. The FCC fixing the spectrum crunch and just generally bringing the FCC into the 21st century, that would be nice. Copyright reform, that would be good too. And as we talked earlier in the show, updating the federal wiretapping laws and other statutes having to do with search and seizure when it relates to electronic information.
Jillian, do you have a wish list for Washington right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of that stuff's on it. Definitely copyright reform, definitely the patent stuff. A lot of what I'm focused on is international. And so my biggest one right now is fixing our export control regulations. Right now, it's just far too easy to export some of the worst technologies that allow for government surveillance. And we've seen this in countries like Egypt and Bahrain. While at the same time, on the other hand, we've got export regulations that prevent good technology from getting to people in countries like Syria, Sudan, and Iran. The goal of those export regulations is to prevent these things from being used against citizens by their governments. But at the same time, you've got Syrians who can't update their antivirus software and are then susceptible to malware attacks. So, I would say those are at the top of my list. Just more continued funding into the efforts that like circumvention technology that allow for greater internet freedom globally.
So over at the BitSpot blog, Larry, there is a post about the Obama administration, the FCC under the Obama administration in the second term, focusing on more spectrum. Do you think that those efforts are likely to prove fruitful?
Unfortunately, no. Mm-hmm. I think that the FCC is still sort of stuck between a couple of big rocks and hard places when it comes to spectrum. Sometime over the last 4 to 10 years, we've changed somewhat dramatically, I think, in terms of spectrum in a very significant way. We no longer have unassigned and usable spectrum. The frontier, if you will, has closed. And going forward, at least until technology, races ahead and we find new ways to use frequencies that we can't currently use, we're going to be in a kind of a trade system where we're trying to retire old technologies that aren't making efficient use of spectrum so that we can free it up for more useful technologies, more valuable technologies. And that's unfortunately the world that the FCC is going to be living in, certainly for the next administration. The two main sources right now of kind of underutilized or unused spectrum, there's one in the private sector, and that's over-the-air television and radio. And in the public sector, it's the federal government itself, and particularly the Department of Defense and the Department of Justice. Between those two sources, we could free up a tremendous amount of spectrum that's badly needed for the explosion in mobile communications, and particularly for mobile data. But both those groups are proving extremely resistant. They're kind of dragging their heels. On the private side, the FCC has authority to conduct these new incentive auctions. They're moving forward with them, but the broadcasters have made it clear they're not especially conducive to participating in those. And in any event, it's going to be years before, in the best case, something happens. On the public side, President Obama issued an executive order requiring federal agencies to identify a couple hundred megahertz of very valuable spectrum that they weren't using or weren't using well that could also be auctioned for private use. And the agencies have just been doing their best and very successfully so to drag their heels and drag the process out. And so far, nothing has really happened. The FCC doesn't really have the authority to force the issue. It would really take the White House kind of stepping back into this and doing so much more aggressively than they did a couple of years ago when they issued the order in the first place.
I think I can envision why the Department of Defense needs Spectrum. Why does the Justice Department?
Oh, the FBI. Ah. That's part of the Justice Department. So the FBI, has... Here's one of the big problems. Of course, the DOD needs spectrum. They have more spectrum than any agency in any country in the world does. Both the FBI and the Department of Defense run several systems with very old technology that make extraordinarily inefficient use of spectrum. So, for example, both of them have video surveillance systems that are very old and that operate essentially on an analog basis instead of on a digital basis. If we just got them to, move over to secured but private video surveillance networks, or, if that's not good enough, build their own digital video surveillance networks, that would free up a tremendous amount of spectrum all by itself.
And we've come full circle right back to our privacy discussion, I see. Of course, that's on a lot of people's wish lists for Washington 2 in the new term. Evan, anything on yours?
Well, they would fall broadly under the two categories of privacy and intellectual property, where, items on my wish list would be. As far as intellectual property goes, we are in serious need of patent reform. Rather than go into details for what I would like to see in patent reform, I would just refer people to defendinnovation.org. That's a project of the EFF that right there on the homepage sets forth seven principles that really, I think, would pretty much solve the patent problem. The problem that we need to address is trollish behavior, both in the patent sphere and in the copyright sphere too. So copyright reform, I would really love to see something that disincents people from going after huge statutory damages when those really aren't warranted. I think that could probably be the best way to see some copyright reform to do away with trollish behavior of the Business Software Alliance, for example, and what we used to see from the RIAA and from the porn companies. That trollish behavior doesn't help anyone except the plaintiffs. Again, looking at this opportunism of plaintiffs' lawyers in this situation. With privacy, all the stuff we talked about earlier with the overhaul of the Wiretap Act, I'm not sure I would care to see any legislation. So I don't know if this would be on the wish list for what I would want President, the legislative and the executive branch to do. Maybe this is okay having just been in the judicial branch with the Jones case in the past year. But the surveillance technologies are going to become more pervasive. So I would really like to see a concerted effort to make sure that our civil liberties aren't being violated by the increasing ability of technology to monitor us 24/7 in public spaces, the issue in the Jones case. So there may come a time where there needs to be some legislative attention to that issue. It looks like it's probably all right for now with the holding in the Jones case. But what I would like to see is Justice Sotomayor and Justice Alito's thinking kind of become the majority opinion rather than kind of a narrow reading of the Fourth Amendment underlying Justice Scalia's opinion, the property interest of putting a GPS device on someone's car being what carries the day in the Fourth Amendment. I'd like to see a more progressive view of what personal privacy in public spaces means become the mainstream rationale for protecting our civil liberties. So that's definitely a long-term wish list item that would extend really from here on forever. I don't know if that's something that necessarily we would want to see legislative or executive attention on in the next term.
Vivek Wadhwa, writing in the innovations column for the Washington Post, has a couple of other points we haven't raised today that definitely come into play as well. He raises education, freedom and competition, which of course we were talking about with the antitrust investigation against Google, and investing in sustainable, renewable energy solutions, all those things are critical to the health and beneficial economies of the technology industry. Evan, you were bringing up patent reform. Let's hone in and look a little more closely at some patent cases in the news this week. Kaboom. All right. You were talking about trolls, Evan. We've got a nice little trolling case that apparently has been going on since 2008. I hadn't heard of it before, but it got written up over at Forbes. There is a Texas firm called TQP with two employees, Michael Jones and Eric Spangenberg, who Mr. Jones, I guess, filed the patent that he claims governs everything related to HTTPS encrypted portions of the web. So they've been suing people right and left and don't show any sign of stopping. In fact, the quote here at the end of this article is from Mr. Spangenberg. Let's see. The world would be a better place if people understood intellectual property. I don't understand why just because it's prevalent, it should be free. So it doesn't sound like they're going to go anywhere and are going to continue to say that all your HTTPS are belong to us. So any thoughts on this one, Evan?
Well, you got two employees. One of them is Michael Jones. The other is this lawyer. I thought the quote was going to be Mr. Jones and me sit around and file bogus patent lawsuits, but you know, for what that's worth, I hadn't heard of this outfit either. But man, this guy's been doing all right. You know, looks like a lot of success, and you know, a very broad patent. This claim reads pretty broadly. I was interested, mm-hmm. you know, what Bruce Schneier's involvement in all of this, because Spangenberg, whatever his name is here, you know, his version of the story is that Bruce Schneier, you know, obviously the security expert, had helped him out. But if talking to Schneier himself, he's like, wait, no, I've been helping out some defendants. So, I mean, this is just another example of many that shows how trollish behavior doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I don't agree, in the interview here, Spangenberg is saying that it's like, you know, if you buy a 100-foot lot in the middle of Manhattan, you're not required to develop it. Companies have the right to protect their IP dollars. I just think that analogy breaks down pretty quickly, because the whole notion of the intellectual property rights is the fact that there's a trade-off that serves the public interest quite greatly if you really buy into it and look at the constitutional reasoning for intellectual property rights. So, you know, the fact that a person has this right to be so exclusive in their intellectual property rights doesn't extend to its absurd conclusion that is necessary to support this lawyer's analogy here. So I don't like it. It certainly is benefiting him richly, being representing a non-practicing entity like this, but it does not serve the ends of intellectual property law. And, you know, we just say that over and over again. How many times have we uttered that sentiment on the show? And this is another example of that.
Right. Larry, this seems like a pretty fundamental way to the way the a fundamental aspect of the way the internet operates. Should this kind of thing be patentable?
No, it shouldn't. And I think that's the real problem. I'm not a huge fan of non-practicing entities, or, you know, as we often appropriately call them, patent trolls. But I don't think that's the big problem here. I mean, the patent trolls can serve a useful function in the system. If you have a inventor or small company that either can't afford to bring its product to market yet, or, you know, more often is being litigated against by a much larger company with very deep pockets, that's really where these firms originated, was, you know, sort of buying up the patents of people who couldn't afford to defend them against very large companies. And there's some, you know, really sad examples of that even recently. The real problem here is not the trolls. It's the generosity of the patent offices in granting patents, and particularly with granting technology-related patents. They don't have the experience. They don't do a particularly good job at reviewing them. They're incentivized to get through as many applications as quickly as possible. It's easier to say yes than it is to say no. And the result has been essentially that the patent office has outsourced the process of actually reviewing applications to the courts, so that they say yes, and then you know, interested parties have to bring litigation to determine if, in fact, this is a patent that should have ever been granted in the first place. It's a tremendously inefficient and expensive way to run the system. If we, you know, first stopped granting patents quite so generously, number one, and number two and three, if we simply got rid of these relatively new categories of software patents and business method patents, that nobody thought were patentable until a sort of ambiguous case came up in the federal circuit, and the Supreme Court is sort of hedged about whether it likes that case or not. If we simply said, you know, software patents don't exist, business method patents don't exist, and the patent office should not be quite so generous about granting technology patents in the first place, I think that would solve many more of our problems than beating up on the trolls, as fun as that might be.
It would just starve them of resources on which to survive. So it would be a more effective remedy getting rid of that behavior if you disincentivized that behavior, didn't provide the substrate on which they could grow, right?
Yeah, I think it's partly that. I was following the tweets from this Santa Clara University Law School conference today on patent reform, and there was a sort of intriguing study that said just knocking the length of patents down by a few years would eliminate, you know, more than a majority of the patent troll behavior all by itself.
Yeah, I've been following those as well. Apparently, Professor Goldman has been saying they've been getting a lot of traction on Twitter, so that's a good thing that people are paying attention to that conference. Let's see. Beating up on the trolls reminded me of the fact that The Hobbit's coming out this month. Don't go beating up on the trolls. You might hurt your hand. A little side reference there. Okay, so Jillian had to run. She is a busy person at EFF with lots to do, but she says goodbye to everybody, and we are thrilled that she was able to join us. Always great to have the EFF represented here on This Week in Law. Let's move on to the news about Apple and HTC settling their patent litigation in a secret 10-year license agreement. I say secret, not that the agreement's secret, but the terms of it are. Analysts are speculating that Apple might make as much as $6 to $8 per phone out of the arrangement, or as that pencils out, about $180 million to $280 million in annual revenue, given the fact there will likely be 30 to 35 million HTC Android devices shipped in 2013. That's via PC Magazine. So, Evan, what do you think? Dan Gilmore wonders if Apple just made a strategic retreat in its global war on Android. Would you go that far?
It's definitely strategic, obviously. I don't know if there's any good reason to call it a retreat. You know, I don't feel like I have a very keen insight into all this stuff, because there are people who just, I think, sit and read The Verge all day and, you know everything there is about all the different battles going on in the patent wars. But, you know, I'm going to go out and say, and you can check the record on this, check the transcript, Candy. I saw this coming a long time ago, mm-hmm. that this is how it would work out. I've always compared it to the user interface wars of, you know, back in the early days of Microsoft and Apple, and that there were going to be agreements put into place. There would be certain, you know, big court decisions that have to deal with all this stuff, but that eventually people are going to come to their senses and do some licensing here to normalize the marketplace and all this stuff. We can't just go around beating up on each other forever on all this stuff. So this comes as no surprise to me. And, you know, I guess when I'll really be surprised is when we see some agreement between Apple and Samsung. But that's just because I would be surprised to see the egos and the entrenched nature of that dispute be overcome. You know, but I think this is the right way, and I think this is going to benefit everyone. And I don't see it as a retreat. I just think of it probably as a pretty smart business decision on balance, factoring in the costs of what it would take to go ahead and fight on this stuff.
Yeah, litigation is always the least desirable route to go if you can avoid it. And apparently the parties found a way that it made sense for both of them to do that. Larry, what do you think?
Well, it's hard to say, of course, because as you note, we don't have the terms of the agreement. That's always that's always a limiting factor. But yeah, I basically agree with Evan. This is there's some amazing statistics out here. Right now, I think I just read recently that 1 in 6 active patents that are still active, that is, have to do with smartphone technology.
Wow.
And also that Google and Apple in the last 2 years have spent more money on patent litigation than they have on research and development. Right. So it gives you a sense that there's been some really good infographics showing just how complicated this is. But there's essentially a trade war going on worldwide, having to do with pretty much everything having to do with smartphone technology. And it's not just lawsuits; it's also sort of international trade bodies and national trade bodies. So they're suing, but they're also blocking imports of devices in different countries. And it's really a cluster bomb, and it's eventually going to start to interfere with consumers, and that's when it gets real. But it's true, as Evan says, one of the things that I've noticed as a Silicon Valley local for a long time is whenever there's a sort of two big companies and they want to start negotiating about working together, generally speaking, the first thing they do is each file patent litigation against the other one. It's a sort of way of starting to get some leverage in the discussion that usually doesn't get litigated to the end. There's cross-licensing deals that wind up happening that sort of protect both of them and also, by the way, help to keep out new competitors from the respective markets. Sometimes governments have to intervene when that happens as well. But it's a mess. I think what's interesting, and Mike Masnick at TechDirt has been reporting on this quite a bit, is that some judges now are starting to buck the trend here and refuse to participate to the extent that they legally can do so in these litigations that are clearly aimed at just improving negotiating position in other activities. It got started when my former boss, Chicago-based federal appellate judge Richard Posner, threw out one of the Apple-Samsung cases, dismissed it with prejudice, and sort of basically told both parties to go find some other venue to fight their battles. But a couple other courts have now taken up a similar position and have been much more aggressive, I think, about managing their patent docket to say, the federal courts are not your free arena in which to negotiate licensing agreements in the guise of patent lawsuits. Go away. And hopefully more judges will become more aggressive about that and force this worldwide trade war to come to an end before, consumers start to feel the pinch.
From your mouth to their benches, Larry. Let's hope that happens. Let's move on to our resource and tip of the week. Our resource of the week is over at NPR, an article there from the Associated Press called "Critical Online Reviews Can Carry Legal Risks," heavily quoting our friend Professor Eric Goldman, who points out the reality is that we bet our house every time we post content online. So the article is running down some just common sense points of things to bear in mind so that you don't wind up on the wrong end of a defamation suit. So I encourage you to go check that out. Also, over at Boing Boing, right, I think it was on Election Day. Yep, here it is, Tuesday, November 6th. Shani Jardin posted a great piece on Instagramming the ballot. I guess people's ballots were showing up on photo sharing sites as they were going into the voting booth. And Shani's piece runs down in great detail, what you can do in which states. Some states let you bring in your smartphone. Some do not. And even ones that do let you bring in the smartphone might not let you actually photograph and share pictures of your ballot. A lot of people weighing in that, our smartphones are basically our notepads these days. If I'm going to bring in a slate, so I can remember when I did my research and decided who I was going to vote for, who all those choices were, I need to have it there on the phone. So some states let you do that. Some don't. Before you decide to bring a phone or a camera into the voting booth, you should check. And that's our tip of the week. So with that, folks, I'm very excited to wrap up this fun and interesting and wide-ranging episode of This Week in Law. It's been great chatting with you again, Larry.
Likewise. And Denise, I have to say, I'm sorry, I didn't notice until just now all your Thanksgiving decorations. That's a very nice touch. and if you want someone to go see The Hobbit with you, I will be happy to stand in line.
Yes, definitely. I want to go. So let's make a date and go do that. We're actually going to be dark for Thanksgiving next week. So we're bidding you a fond farewell and celebrating the holiday a bit early. If you are jonesing for your weekly This Week in Law fix and you just can't get through a Friday without the kind of thing that we do here on the show, I encourage you to check out I did a conference. The Sarcastic Rover Does a Science, I Did a Conference. We went up to on Hollywood at the end of October, and I brought the fabulous film crew that has done a number of the Twit Live specials, and they helped me do a bunch of interviews with the very interesting people there, as well as footage of a lot of the panels. This was the Always On Hollywood event that I've gone to for a few years running. It's always a great event. So if you want to get a view of that, go check it out at the Twit Live specials link, and you can watch that next week instead. How about that?
It's really good.
Thank you.
I watched it. You're a real pro, Denise. That was you did a great job interviewing all those folks, and you know, it was a really interesting topic, and you really did a great job of bringing it all out. So everybody should go watch it, not just because you say so, but because I do also.
Well, I greatly appreciate that. What are you doing for Thanksgiving, Evan?
Just heading to my folks' house in southern Indiana. Wife and our two sons are going there, so just getting out of town for a little bit. And what about you? What's up with you? Said you're we're obviously not doing the show, so what's going to keep you busy?
No, we're not doing the show. Staying local in Southern California. I've got tons of family rolling into town, plus we're getting together with some friends, and so it's just going to be a huge feast and kids running everywhere. And looking forward to it.
Right on. Yeah, that'll be fun.
So we hope that your Thanksgivings are equally as joyous and full of fun and friends and family. And we'll miss you next week, but we'll see you next time in early December. Until then, do we have one more show in November?
I don't think so.
No, I don't think so. I think we're early December after that. So until then, do head on over to our Facebook page and our Google Plus page, where we will be sandboxing stories for our next show. We'd love to have your feedback on this show or any of the others. So you can email us. I'm Denise at twit.tv. Evan is Evan at twit.tv. Or find us on Twitter. I'm D Howell over there. Evan is Internet Cases. If you are not regularly checking out Evan's blog, you should at internetcases.com, because he regularly covers the kinds of things that we talk about on the show as well. And Larry, you can find just all over the web. Larry, you are one of the most prolific and brilliant thinkers that I've ever come across. So it's wonderful that you do all this great work and help us understand all these hard issues. And we really, really appreciate you coming on the show on a semi-regular basis and doing it here with us live and in recorded form.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you very much for that.
All right. So you have a happy Thanksgiving as well. And we'll see you all soon. Take care, everyone.